From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, journalist Philip Gurevich won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his book about the genocide in Rwanda. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with Gurevich about writing the book. Last Saturday, photographer David Douglas Duncan was given the Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence and Bravery from the Marine Corps for his war photos, one of which was on last week's cover of Newsweek. We'll listen back to an interview with him about his war photos. Also, a language game with no rules. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about Yoruba Panto. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, journalist Philip Gurevich won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his book about the genocide in Rwanda called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families. It also won a George Polk Book Award. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Gurevich about writing the book. Gurevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He made his first of several trips to Rwanda 1 year after the genocide. He says he wanted to know how Rwandans understood what had happened in their country and how they were getting on in the aftermath. The genocide began when the Hutu-led government of Rwanda called on the Hutu majority to murder everyone in the Tutsi minority. I asked Gurevich to give us a sense of the genocide's proportions.
The best estimates are that at least 800,000 Rwandans, one-tenth of the population, were killed in a period of about 100 days. If you boil that down, that actually comes to the extraordinary statistic of 5.5 people a minute murdered every minute over a period of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, week after week, for 10 weeks, at least 100 days. And it's a kind of staggering speed of just simple slaughter.
When you got to Rwanda, one of the places you went to was a church that has become almost a genocide memorial. Would you describe what you saw there?
Well, this is a church in eastern Rwanda. And it sits on a little hilltop, as so many Rwandan hilltops have churches on top of them. And it looks essentially, or looked at the time, from a distance, very much like any church anywhere on a hilltop, a kind of nice brick Italianate cathedral. And as one came up to it, the only thing that was striking is that it seemed a little bit overgrown around it. And then entering some of the outbuildings, the floor was simply covered in corpses, mostly somewhat decomposed corpses. And this had been a place where hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people had sought refuge from the surrounding community when the massacres began in April of 1994. And this was something that happened nationwide. People who were endangered, targeted, slated for death, that is to say, all Tutsis and any number of Hutus who might have been intermarried with Tutsis or who felt that their political opposition to the ruling party that was ordaining these massacres made them also targets for death. They fled seeking sanctuary in places like churches, public places like schools, government offices, sometimes stadia. And they hoped that in concentration like this, they would find sanctuary. In this church, and the church that we're speaking about is called Nyarabuye, the mayor of that area had instructed the local Tutsi population, well, maybe you'll be safer if you go to the church. And several days later, he had led the militia bands of Hutu power militia to slaughter the Tutsis who had sought refuge there. And the government later, when it had discovered this church, the new government of Rwanda, the people who were now governing after the genocide, had decided to leave it, as they had found it, with the bodies strewn about as a commemorative site. And it was quite a graphic way to recognize just the scope of what it means to have 100, 1,000, 2,000 people killed. And then you think about numbers like 800,000, because when you're in a place like that, it really does seem like there are dead people everywhere.
You make the point in your book that the genocide wasn't about chaos. It wasn't about anarchy. The genocide was very well orchestrated. It was the product of order, the product of authoritarianism. Can you explain how the word was gotten out?
The word to do the killing.
Yeah.
The idea that it was time to kill the Tutsis, the orders, as it were gotten out through many levels. One of the main levels was the radio. There was a long history in Rwanda by 1994 of state-sponsored hostility and animosity towards the Tutsi population, including periodic massacres, the idea that a Tutsi life was quite deeply devalued by the time that the genocide began. At that point, the local administrators were receiving encouragement, shall we say, from their higher-ups. And there's a very hierarchical political and social structure in Rwanda. And really, at all levels, it was disseminating outwards to those smaller and smaller localer and localer units that this was, it was now a time of killing. And a message that had sort of been a rather conventional us or them attitude of ethnic division became a kill or be killed message. And there had been long structuring and training of the militia bands throughout the country. Now, simultaneously, you had the radio encouraging the struggle, encouraging what was called cleaning the bush, do your work. These were the sorts of euphemisms that were used for describing the extermination of the Tutsi population. At the same time as you had that, you had local leaders encouraging people. You had state figures from the government. You had the prime minister. You had all of the various ministers in the cabinet and the president himself, the acting president at the time, traveling around the country, leading rallies, congratulating people in places where massacres had taken place for work well done, and encouraging those in places where the massacres had yet to be completed to do their work. And the extent of this, although it's hard to find, for instance, a tape recording of somebody saying, kill all the Tutsis now, you would have these euphemisms like, do your work, or eliminate the enemies of the people, and so forth. These were completely clearly understood and had a long legacy. And so the message was really disseminated very intensively at very many different levels, both by example and by word of mouth.
Since this was a kind of general population massacre where everybody was encouraged to do the killing, and most of these people were unarmed, it wasn't a professional army with armed soldiers, what were the methods that were used for the genocide? I know machetes were very often used. What else was done?
Machetes, clubs, hoes, in other words, garden tools. Virtually everybody in Rwanda has a machete, and they don't have it for chopping up their neighbors, as people might imagine here from the sort of press coverage. It's the all-purpose tool. People use it. It's an agrarian culture. It's basically a peasant culture. You see people walking everywhere with machetes. They cut their firewood with it. They cut their grass with it. They dig holes with it. They build their houses with it. They use it for just about everything. So it's a ubiquitous tool. Nevertheless, in the months preceding the massacres, there have been documented large orders were made by the government on behalf of the militias to stockpile machetes. They were ordering them from China. They were ordering them from their own factories that were manufacturing machetes locally. So that there was a clear effort to make sure that the population was armed, even in this rudimentary fashion. And then a few people with guns or a few people with hand grenades could easily create the militarized context that was needed to spur on the population.
You write that most of the dogs were shot during the genocide. Why?
Well, this was a peculiar side effect. They were really shot after the genocide. I had noticed when I was in Rwanda that there were very, very, very few dogs, and it was very quiet at night, and that's not very typical of outdoor countries, shall we say, places where a lot of the life is taking place in a temperate climate outdoors. The Rwandan dogs were eating the Rwandan dead. And as the rebel army, the Rwandese Patriotic Front, that liberated Rwanda from the genocide, moved across the country, taking territory, they began to shoot the dogs that they saw eating the dead, essentially in disgust and fury. These dogs were, nobody wanted this such a dog around anymore. And so they were killed. And it really tells you of kind of, there's something about this image which I find particularly lurid and sad in the sense that the dogs were made masterless by the killing. Masterless, they ran loose and ate their masters. And it tells you how deeply a society is torn apart when even the dogs can't be left to survive.
Some of the priests in Rwanda joined in the genocide, and you spoke to one of the reverends who was alleged to have participated in it. In fact, he was indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal. And I'm thinking of Reverend Ntake Rudimana. Tell us what he told you. Did he admit to any of the charges?
No. Pastor Elizaphan Ntake Rudimana was the president of the Adventist Church in the western Rwandan province of Kibuye, which is a beautiful mountainous area along the edge of Lake Kivu, which forms the border with what was then Zaire and is now the Congo. He was the president of the Adventist Church for the entire province, and there he lived in a town called Muganero. And I had traveled out to Kibuye when I was in Rwanda in the summer of 96, and I visited Muganero, and there I spoke with a number of survivors who described how, as in the church massacre site that I described earlier at Nyarubuye, people from the area, fearing death, Tutsis and had fled, seeking refuge at the church center. And as they amassed there, they began to fear that they themselves would be massacred and began to hear rumors that they were being directed there to be massacred, not to be saved. Amongst their number were seven Tutsi pastors who were members of the Adventist Church, church authorities. And when they learned that on a particular Saturday morning they were to be killed, they wrote a letter to Pastor Takirutimana, the Hutu church president, asking that he intercede on their behalf. And it's from that letter, actually, that I take the title of my book. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. They were asking him in that strange, formal, polite, deferential language to intercede on their behalf and save their lives. And the story I heard in Muganero was that, in fact, he had said something to the effect of, well, no, you must die. God no longer wants you, which I thought were particularly chilling words. And then I learned that he was living in Laredo, Texas, of all places. He had a son who some years ago had become a doctor in the United States and was living in Laredo, Texas. And Pastor Takirutimana had fled after the genocide into Zaire and then into Zambia. And from Zambia, he had immigrated with a green card to the United States. And so I went down to Laredo and I tracked him down, or I tracked down the son, and through him was able to meet the father, who wanted to speak to me, I represented a reporter at that point, because he claimed he wanted to clear his good name. And he claimed that far from having helped or orchestrated the massacre, at that point he was under indictment from the War Crimes Tribunal. I knew it, he didn't. It was a secret indictment that I had learned about. He said, well, you know, it was a time of chaos, it was a time of anarchy, I never did anything that I've been accused of. In fact, his alibi, which was a rather extraordinary alibi, he said, I went, when the killing in my town began, I went to the next town over, and the quote was, where they had killed everybody, and so there was peace. It's a strange way of defining peace, I thought, for a man of God who was also accused of massacring his own congregation. And it was odd. I had heard about this letter, and I asked him about it, and he told me the story that, yes, indeed, he'd received such a letter, but there was nothing he could do. And then I said, well, what exactly did the letter say? Because up until then, I had really been told about it only by survivors in Rwanda. And he told me, well, here. And he handed me a copy of the letter. He'd kept the letter for all this time. What I've never been able to understand is, did he think it exonerated him? Because in many ways, it seems to raise more doubts about his role than it answers. He was arrested the day after I met him at that point in Laredo, Texas, by the FBI on this indictment from the UN Tribunal. But it gives a sense also of how widespread this was. It was something that infiltrated the deepest levels of church hierarchies and that also fans out then quickly into the entire world.
My guest is Philip Gurevich, author of a book about the Rwandan genocide. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Philip Gurevich about his book about the Rwandan genocide, which just won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Most of the people who carried out the genocide in Rwanda were just regular people. They weren't part of a trained fighting force. You can't say they were indoctrinated while they were in the military to become fighting machines or killing machines, because they weren't, most of them, in the military. I know you've tried to answer the question, how can regular people participate in a genocide? What kind of answers or conclusions have you been able to come up with?
I can explain and describe and account for any number of factors which contribute to what appear to be the pattern of behavior one saw in Rwanda. But in the end, I have to say I'm left somewhat mystified and dissatisfied. And I decided that there are some things where one has to respect the mystery, even the mystery of this kind of an atrocity. But there's an example that I think is very interesting. I once was stuck on a road late at night and in the darkness in Rwanda, and a car broke down, and I was stuck out there. And suddenly there was a woman screaming in the valley down below, and this screaming got picked up by everybody around. I couldn't see anything. It was in the darkness down below. And one heard this tremendous hubbub in a little village. And after about an hour, some soldiers came up on the road leading a prisoner, and it turned out that this man had broken into the woman who had screamed. He'd broken into her house and assaulted her, apparently trying to rape her. And I was told that in Rwanda, in village by village, in the small communities and larger, when you're offended, when somebody attacks you, when you call for help, everybody else is supposed to pick up this call and also come running to your assistance. And if you don't help out in this way, you yourself are considered a bit of an accomplice. And it was explained to me as totally normal. Well, of course, isn't this how it is where you live? I mean, this is community. And what happened in Rwanda is that idea of community was turned on its head. If you didn't run to help in the killing, you were an accomplice. If you didn't participate in slaughtering, then you were the one who had to explain yourself. And so this very tight community system was used to purge the Tutsi population.
I think it's fair to say that most Americans can't keep straight the Hutus from the Tutsis. What separates them in Rwanda?
Relatively little, except a legacy of distorted identity politics, I think it's fair to say. Nobody knows exactly how these terms originated, where they came from in before recorded history. But at the time of colonization by European explorers, which was really only about 100 years ago in the 1890s, there were these groups called Hutu and some called Tutsi within Rwandan society, and it really seems to have been more of a caste or a class division representing economic and social status, the tiny Tutsi minority being an elite. The Europeans manipulated this around ideas that they brought with them of race science, which is to say pseudoscience of racial categorization, and created really ultimately an almost apartheid-like system in Rwanda in which the Tutsi elite were considered a superior master race. They were certain physical stereotypes which made Tutsi tall, skinny, and more European in their features, and therefore, of course, that contributed also to the idea that they were superior in the eyes of Europeans, and the Hutu as a kind of slave or inferior race. The fact of the matter is it's very difficult physically or otherwise to distinguish them, and that modern historians and ethnographers simply reject the idea that they're two distinct groups. They speak the same language, they've worshipped the same gods, and they live together intermingled.
And when Belgium colonized Rwanda, they gave the Tutsis more authority, more power. And then when Rwanda got its independence, the Hutus ousted the Tutsi leaders. So I guess there's a bit of a history of back and forth there between the Hutus and the Tutsis about who was controlling who and who was ousting who.
Well, yeah. I mean, essentially, you had a small elite group, the Tutsi, who enjoyed all the privileges under the colonial state. And then, in the name of majority rule and independence, the Hutu made a bid for power. And it was actually, strikingly, only at that very moment in 1959 that one has the first instance of organized political violence between the two groups, where Hutu and Tutsi were sort of violently clashing. Although one often hears of this as some kind of ancient tribal warfare, there was never before any recorded instance of this kind. And it's essentially a very modern phenomenon. It's one in which political leadership, seeking to create its base, seeking to manipulate its constituency, thrives on creating the bogey of the other group as a sort of mortal enemy and a constant peril. And in this case, in Rwanda, although it's happened differently elsewhere, Hutus had power since 1959, 1960, and cultivated very strongly the idea of this tiny Tutsi minority as a mortal enemy within.
You really don't like the kind of reporting that says, well, this is a story in which there's problems on both sides. It's just one of those historical, intractable messes that's, you know, pretty incomprehensible.
No, I think the nicest thing that can be said about such reporting is that it's lazy and sort of more damagingly, both to our understanding and to the people there in the places, it's wrong. It doesn't seek to really recognize the political forces that are at play that are defining these massive events. It doesn't seek to understand the events in the terms that they themselves are taking place.
Philip Gurevich, recorded last year after the publication of his book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. This week, it won a National Book Critics Circle Award. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Philip Gurevich. Also, the war photos of David Douglas Duncan. One of them was on the cover of last week's Newsweek. And now that Europeans have a common currency, linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us about efforts to have a common language. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with journalist Philip Gurevich. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of a book about the 1994 genocide in Rwanda and its aftermath, called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families. I asked him about the political events that led to the genocide.
Two things can be said to be form the sort of immediate background to the Rwandan genocide. The first, that between 1990 and 1994, Rwanda was in a state of on-again, off-again, but continuous civil war in which a predominantly Tutsi, but not exclusively Tutsi, rebel group was opposing the entrenched power which was known as Hutu power, of the president and his extremist entourage, and then a background within that of sort of very complex political turmoil with many, many Hutu opposition groups. And then most specifically, the interesting thing is that while the background was this war, and it was in, during this war that the Hutu power extremists who would lead the genocide built up their militia bases, built, held practice massacres, cultivated the logic, the rhetoric, the propaganda, and the organizational structures that would preside over the genocide. It was only when a peace agreement was struck, a power-sharing arrangement in August of 93, that the Hutu power leaders ratcheted up for what they themselves called the final solution. And it was only when they actually had to share power that they said, there is no solution but to completely eliminate those with whom we are being asked to share.
Tens of thousands of people have been arrested for participating in the genocide. Did you visit one of the prisons on any of your trips there?
I'm afraid I visited at least a half a dozen of them. I say afraid because they're really pretty depressing spectacle. You walk in, and the first thing that sort of strikes you is that these are prisons built quite often maybe for 800 people, 1,000 people. They're large brick fortress-looking areas. And you're looking at 10,000, 11,000 people, 6,000 here, 8,000. They're packed into these spaces. They're packed so tightly that they can barely move. They can't all lie down at the same time. They have to sleep in shifts. They sleep sitting up. Many of them are living outdoors perpetually with just a little bit of plastic sheeting as a roof. And so the first thing that strikes one is these are appalling conditions. On the other hand, they are being fed and given medical care and so forth, primarily by international relief groups. And the other thing that strikes one is, my goodness, a great number of these people are accused for a reason. They may not have been properly arrested by the sort of due process that we would hope for in our fairly well-established justice system, but this is the scale of the crime that was committed here, is that these sorts of numbers certainly do correspond to those who are guilty. It doesn't mean that the people who are in prison until they've been tried can be said to be guilty. But that's one of the things that strikes you. And you see them there, and the other thing that's striking is how very passive much of the prison population is. And it was something that was hard to explain, except that there was the feeling that a terrible, terrible crime had been committed, and that it wasn't extraordinary at all to Rwandans that so many people should be in jail.
You write that you think true genocide and true justice are incompatible. Why?
It is impossible to hold anybody to... If one looks at American courts, they couldn't try 100,000 murder trials, much less 800,000 murder trials, with perfect due process and the sort of carrying it out to the degree and the letter of the law that we would require within the lifetimes of the perpetrators. And we have the most lawyer-heavy, law-driven society in the world. In Rwanda, it's even more impossible. It's simply impossible to account for a crime of that magnitude. And that's part of its attraction, I suspect, to its perpetrators, is if everybody's implicated, nobody's implicated. How can you ever hold anybody to account? How can punishment ever suit the crime? It is a crime that in some very, very disturbing way one has the sense is being gotten away with.
The International War Crimes Tribunal has handed in two convictions so far, one of a former small-town mayor and the other of a former prime minister, the man who was prime minister during the genocide. The former prime minister got life in prison, and he was the first person in history to plead guilty to genocide in a war crimes tribunal. What kind of precedents do you think this war crimes tribunal is setting?
Well, he was the first person to plead guilty to genocide in a war crimes tribunal, but by then Rwanda, in its own courts, had convicted hundreds of people of genocide. So I make the point simply to say Rwanda has been trying people for genocide in the past year and a half. Some of those trials don't meet the sort of standards that we would like them to. Overall, they're remarkably varied sentences coming out of them. That's one way to judge the independence of such a court. The International Tribunal is setting an odd set of precedents. It's hard to know that the prime minister who was convicted confessed, and he confessed in a deal where he was trying to guarantee, he basically said, I will confess in exchange for the protection of my family in exile. And he's been complaining about whether or not they're protected at the level of well-being that he would like them to be. He made a deal, and it was very important both for Rwanda and for this court to have this conviction. I don't think it's not a court that is capable of bringing justice for the Rwandan genocide. It is a court that is capable of doing some pioneering work in international law at a very slow pace that has very little or very delayed bearing on Rwanda's recovery, if one can speak of recovery, from the genocide.
In the meantime, I think about 1 million Hutu people have returned to Rwanda. So this means that the Tutsi and the Hutu who tried to kill them are living together again. And I wonder what kind of interactions you observed.
Well, it's one of the great and bewildering things about Rwanda, and one of the things that I found made the story so fascinating, that actually makes it a story that is so far from being over, and that is, never before has a society that was so divided, that literally one part of the population was called upon to eliminate the other part, and many members of it did participate in so doing, and many people were killed, that the both groups are being asked to live together as neighbors again, and to form a society as Rwandans, first of all, and to create some idea of a Rwandan national identity. It's an enormous challenge. What's striking is a lot of people are giving it a go. These categories, Tutsi and Hutu, are more laden with meaning in the aftermath of the bloodletting than ever before. It's only prudent to be suspicious. It's only prudent to be fearful. And it's a huge burden of vengeful feelings that people carry with them. At the same time, one sees a great deal of interacting. I mean, I know many intermarried couples who remain intermarried. What matters ultimately to people is how individuals behaved. And it's the great problem is that it's hard to know. It's hard to know unless you very well do know. In other words, it's hard to know outside your small community. And I think, if anything, it makes people wary of one another very deeply.
You say that your book is in part about how people imagine themselves and one another, and that the book is about how we imagine our world. I'm wondering how reporting on this story and spending time in Rwanda has changed your view of your world.
There's a certain level on which I think it makes me feel that we are all somewhat less safe than we would like to imagine. Not because I think that we're all in immediate danger of being hacked up by our neighbors, but because I think for the 50 years since the Genocide Convention was passed, and certainly in the way that the Holocaust, which is sort of the defining genocide in modern consciousness, has been remembered, there's an increasing tendency to accept the principles, never again, and the world must oppose such things, on a somewhat facile level, which is to say we all stand opposed to genocide after it's happened. But what Rwanda also showed us, that the idea that we would act out of a sense of common humanity to defend people before such a slaughter simply doesn't hold up. The world doesn't care to act in these situations. It holds back. And that it means, in some deep way, I think what I saw in Rwanda is to think of these things as humanitarian situations, and to think of them facilely, I think, as sort of we are opposed to them and therefore we behave well, that denouncing evil and acting against evil are not the same, and that these are very complex political things that are taking place, and that if one doesn't look at them as such and seek to unravel them, one is at greater risk, I think, of falling prey to them.
Well, Philip Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Philip Gurevich recorded last year after the publication of his book, We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, Stories from Rwanda. This week it won a National Book Critics Circle Award. Coming up, the war photos of David Douglas Duncan. This is Fresh Air. Last week, photographer David Douglas Duncan was given the Lifetime Achievement Award for Excellence and Bravery from the Marine Corps for his war photos. One of those photos was on the cover of the March 8th edition of Newsweek. A retrospective of his work is at the LBJ Library and Museum in Austin. David Douglas Duncan was one of the first photographers on the scene in the Korean War. He hoped that one day his pictures would be viewed as photographic headstones for the men who fought and died in Korea. I spoke with him in 1990 after the republication of his book This Is War, collecting his Korean War photos. Many of the pictures were initially published in Life magazine. This Is War describes what war is like by focusing on the expressions on men's faces, or as Duncan put it, the look in the man's eyes who is taking his last puff on perhaps his last cigarette before he grabs his rifle and attacks an enemy position. So many of the pictures in your book are like portraits of men in war and close-ups of their faces. And I was wondering how you got that close to the men, if they were aware that you were taking their photographs.
No. Under those circumstances, and I'm saying it sounds awkward to say it, but it's a fact, they were usually under combat conditions. And the thing of least concern in the other man, the trooper, the Marine, is what the fellow is doing next to him unless he has a weapon. And a camera had no meaning whatsoever. And remember, I was also older than the guys in Korea, and then much older by the time Vietnam came around. So, and they knew who I was. That's the having survived other situations like that, that I was well known on the battlefield. So there was no, I was just another Marine. So there was no barrier between what they were doing and how they were working. Remember, these are men at work. They were mostly professional Marines, very few draftees. This was their job. And I was doing my job while they did their job, as simple as that.
Is there a photo from your Korean War series that still has the most emotional impact on you when you look at it?
You know, once I asked Pablo Picasso, whom I'd photographed many, many times and made several books on him, what was his favorite painting? And he shoved his hand up in front of my eyes and says, which is my favorite finger? It's all a part of him. So these photographs are all a part of me. I can't say that one's more of a favorite than another because each one relates to another kind of memory, another kind of man. Very few of these men in the book survived, so that you're dealing with many emotions within me. And I tried to simplify that when I shot it, just what did he look like? What did he feel? And as I said some other place, I didn't know anything about what he was thinking. But I knew what I was thinking. So I try to make, I'm very subjective as a war photographer. I want to break your heart.
I want to mention some of the photographs that I found just especially moving. One is a sequence of portraits of a Marine who, in the first portrait there's a...
Leonard Hayworth. He's in the foreground and an old Marine in the background, talking him out of it. Out of his crack up, there are four shots on the double page.
Yeah, actually, that's it.
That's what I'm looking for. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's, if you look at it very closely, you'll see something quite surprising, that the only movement in that picture is in the change of expression in Hayward's face, the guy in front of me, the Marine, who had come back from the front line, which is about 25 feet away, actually, trying to get more ammunition or a replacement for some of the men who had been wounded, a couple had been killed. There was nothing. It was raining. Nothing. And he cracked up, really cracked up. And the old Marine saw him. He'd been wounded. He sat there and forgot his own wounds and talked Leonard out of it. He came from a lovely place called Deer Path, Indiana. Can you imagine? He was killed about 3 weeks later.
Another photograph I want to ask you about. This is toward the end of the book in a sequence of photographs of the Marines on retreat. There's a soldier...
No, wait a minute. They didn't retreat. They're coming down from the reservoir that's on the border of Manchuria and North Korea. And when you retreat from an enemy force of greater strength which is in front of you. You put them behind you and take off. It happens to be that there were more Chinese communist troopers in front of those Marines than behind them. They fought their way through. They didn't retreat. They fought their way out.
Yeah. Well, in the photograph I'm thinking of, there's a soldier sitting on the hood of a Jeep. There's a rifle on his lap. And the expression on his face, I think, will always stay with me. It looks like, well, kind of looks like he looked into hell, and it left him numb.
He was wounded and frozen and riding, because the only way to get him out, if you come out ambulatory, you've tied up a couple of guys, but at least there was still a Jeep running, so he got on the hood of the Jeep. But if you looked to your left, the viewer's left in that photograph, you'll see another Marine who was ambulatory, also wounded, and looking at him with sheer hatred. Can you imagine hating your friend? Because it's an animal factor of survival. It just happens. And the photograph, I think, nailed it down pretty well. But 5 minutes later, it might have changed completely. But that moment, the freezing, walking Marine would like to have had a lift on the hood of the Jeep carrying out his friend.
How cold was it?
In the terms of a thermometer, it was about 40 below zero Fahrenheit. And in those days, that's 40 years ago, we didn't know about chill factor, but the wind was coming out of Siberia at about anywhere from 25 to 50 miles an hour. So I would imagine the chill factor was somewhere between 60 and 80 degrees below. But, you know, sometimes it comes back, I can't think about it, because I think the guy's freezing below zero Fahrenheit. It's really strange. It comes back and grabs you by the throat, and I'm sitting here fiddling with a paperclip on top of your table in the studio, and I think about those guys of another life.
Dude, have people ever told you that they recognized a husband or a boyfriend?
I'm still getting letters 40 years later from one of those freezing Marines, and everybody from Army, Navy, Air Force, other Marines. I don't know exactly who he was. I know where he was. I know the day. It was taken the 9th of December, just at dawn, on the just below the Yalu River. I know what the temperature was. I know many things, but I don't know. I didn't ask his name. But I was on a program a few days ago, and a call came in from Florida, and a woman was sure it was her husband, except I was sure that it wasn't, because the lady calling identified her husband as having been in the Army. This guy was a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible. But let me make one point.
Yeah.
Except for the rare case where it doesn't seem to be injurious, I don't tell them. I let them think it's their husband or brother, father. Now, can you imagine? That's 40 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a call from a lady. I live in the south of France. I got a call a couple of months ago at midnight. She didn't realize how late it was where I live. And she was identifying her father, who was a Marine, and he'd gotten the Medal of Honor, the highest decoration given by the military. But he was killed 3 days before I made that picture. So I told her, so she would never be shattered when she discovered that I'd been kidding her. So I didn't deceive her. The others I'm not deceiving. I just don't disillusion them.
What are the secrets of shooting in combat without becoming a target yourself?
Well, you are a target, of course. It's a lodger. I'm just lucky. In fact, there's a shot there of Ike Fenton. Ike's a guy with somebody said the 1,000-yard stare looking over my shoulder. Ike Fenton, the captain of the assault company up in the beginning. But I tied up with him about a month later during the attack into Seoul, the second chapter of the book. And it had been a terrible night and very cold, strangely enough, for September. And I thought, shallow foxhole, a lot of stuff coming in, stuff being, that is, rifle fire, a little bit of machine gun, and mortar. So you try to stay as low as you can, very low profile. If you roll over, you might catch it in your shoulder. There's that shallow a foxhole. And it slacked off at dawn, a beautiful dawn, cold, and I stood up to stretch. And I thought I'd pulled a chest muscle. And I started to laugh and reached down and held his hand. I held up my fist, and he handled a 30 caliber machine gun slug just hit me in the chest. At the end of its flight, my dear, as far as it would go, and it hit me, and it dropped without even denting me, nothing. So you say, sometimes you're hit, it doesn't make a difference. Other times you get hit, and it does make a big difference. But I've been lucky. I've just been nicked lightly. I've never been really hit. But the other guys around me, sure.
Do you see these photographs as anti-war photos?
You better believe it. That's why I so object to a politician calling these guys boys. Can you imagine? Some boys.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your hospitality.
David Douglas Duncan, recorded in 1990, a retrospective of his work opened this month at the LBJ Library and Museum in Austin. Coming up, a new language for the new European Union? This is Fresh Air. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg is in Rome for a few months, teaching in Naples. He's experiencing firsthand the formation of the European Union from new currency to new languages.
One sign that the euro has arrived is that the Italian police recently arrested some people in Sicily who were counterfeiting the new bills. It probably wouldn't have been hard to get away with. People aren't familiar with the bills yet, and in any case, they're not very memorable. For reasons of political delicacy, the European Union decided to avoid all references to actual persons and places on their money. There are no representations of historical figures like Kant or Voltaire or Erasmus, or of actual places like the Eiffel Tower or the Alhambra or the Colosseum. Instead, the bills have pictures of imaginary structures that are supposed to evoke some abstract notion of the European tradition. The 5-euro note depicts a kind of generic Roman aqueduct. The 10-euro note depicts a stone bridge that looks vaguely like the bridges you might see in Paris or Zurich or Rome without being identical to any of them. There are no human figures, no names, no landscapes in the background. In the end, it gives you the sense of Europe as a purely theoretical idea cooked up by a bunch of bankers, which of course is what a lot of people suspect anyway. The European Union would have done better if they'd followed the example of Diego Morani, an Italian who works as an interpreter at their own offices in Brussels. Morani is the inventor of Europanto, a form of language aimed at allowing Europeans to communicate with one another without having to use English all the time. A lot of the basic structure of Europanto is drawn from English, but users are free to mix in words and expressions from other languages whenever it suits their purposes. For example, here's a Europanto description of the consequences of the Clinton impeachment hearings. After der Lewinsky affair, der U.S. leadership necessit urgent restaurazione, as their image von the old mundiale superpower es noch ein bisschen tarnished. As Morani insists, though, there are no rules for choosing the vocabulary here. Instead of mundiale superpower, the writer could have said Welt superpuissance or world supermacht or whatever. It's like making a Sunday supper. You take what you need from whatever cupboard you have at hand. In the Renaissance, in fact, the humanists described languages like these as macaronic, after the way macaroni used to be served. Europanto isn't offered as a serious alternative to existing languages, the way other made-up languages like Esperanto were. Esperanto is a kind of cult language with as much structure and rules as any natural language has. For all the effort it takes to learn it, you might as well pick up a real language like French or German. Whereas Morani conceived of Europanto as a game, and not a very complicated one at that, comparing it to a real language is like comparing tic-tac-toe to chess. But even though it started as a game, it's been getting a lot of attention. Morani himself has been writing a weekly column in Europanto for newspapers in Brussels and Geneva, and there are a number of lively Europanto sites on the web. Partly the interest in Europanto is just from the pleasure of creating all those unlikely juxtapositions of words. But there are plenty of people, Morani among them, who think that Europanto can free Europeans from dependence on English as a common language. Of course, it wouldn't do for official documents and the like, but there are plenty of situations where you don't need a full-blown language to achieve your purpose. Think of a German trying to reserve a hotel room in Barcelona, or of a group of Italians flirting with some Danes in the Piazza Navona. There's no reason why they should have to hold all their conversation in English or any other single language. It's easier and friendlier to cook up something on the fly. And in the end, you have the sense that's the only way Europe is ever going to be more than just a currency zone, through millions of these little cultural potlucks, not through some grand abstraction dreamed up in a central kitchen in Brussels. Nor is there any reason for us to feel left out. With its freewheeling vocabulary and syntax, Europanto is a game that anybody can play, no matter how bad you are at languages. Finalmente, a foreign lingua que even nous Américains can apprendre à sprechen.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Kathy Wolf. Our engineers today are Chris Fraley and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Book, the magazine for the reading life, covering books, authors, and the stories behind the stories on the shelf, available at bookstores nationwide, and from Putumayo World Music, presenting Celtic Tides, featuring the Chieftains, Clannad, and others, available on CD, video, and DVD, and airing on Bravo on March 18th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Court is in session. I'm the judge, jury, and the prosecution. My words cause minor contusions. Ain't no need for confusion. I'm here to stay. Me and this rap game's bonded together like fusion. Before the talks of a
on the next Fresh Air, rapper and actress Queen Latifah. She has a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
To different nationalities. Burn them seeds like calories. What you need to do is pay homage. It makes no sense to challenge me. Like I said, just me on wax. I react violently.